I've got good news. I've got great news. I've got better news. Good, great, better. We're coming to the end of the book of Romans, and I really wanted to compress. That sounds like I don't like Romans. I do. I just know it's been a lot. I wanted to take chapters 12 and 16 and compress them all into one because generally Paul is saying kind of the same thing in these chapters. But there are a few little points that need emphasis. So my plan, just so you're aware of where we're headed, this week we're going to hit a couple of chapters. Next week we'll hit the 14, 15, 16 and probably have a conclusion. I may have to stretch it one more, but the point is we are nearly through one of the most difficult books in the entire Bible to read and understand. All right? More good news. The material from here on out is not extremely complicated. It is not theologically dense. You very much need to know what it is, but it will not twist your brain up like many of the other things that we've talked about. And because it is not extremely complicated, it is not that long to present it. So we will not have one of those long messages on Romans. Okay? So here comes a shocker, though. There are still some points of disagreement within these chapters of Romans from the traditional perspective and what I want to point out to you. Therefore, let's jump in to the updated version of the Romans Road that we're building. I just realized I don't have a Bible that has Romans in it up here. We can just put it on the screen. I'll use the NRSVUE, okay? Therefore, now, I use that word on purpose. Say this word with me. Un. Un. Someone thinks they're being tricked because a lot fewer people said it the second time. They think I'm about to tell you some kind of joke. That means therefore in Greek. Un, okay? This is an important word in Greek and English and probably all languages. The word therefore serves as a transition word. It shows that what's following is a direct consequence or a conclusion of what's already been said. It's a way of saying, because of everything I just said, this. Because of this, therefore, this. It connects logical arguments. It builds a foundation on something that has been laid. So I've spent a lot of time throughout the series pointing out that Paul is speaking to a specific situation, okay? Not necessarily providing a theological treatise for all mankind, though his points are applicable to all disciples, but that he's specifically speaking to this critical exigency, this urgent and pressing situation that must be addressed. So this therefore that starts chapter 12. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present yourselves, your bodies, as a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. That therefore is really, really important. It signals that the ethical instructions of chapter 12 and 16 are grounded in the theological arguments that preceded it. 1 through 11 built into 12 and 16, but particularly 9 through 11 built into 12 to 16. So he opens 12 by saying, all that I just told you, therefore, I'm going to tell you this. They're connected. It is not a major gear shift, okay? It's not Paul going in a totally different direction. It's not that he lost his way, that he had this dogmatic doctrinal thesis going in 1 through 8, then he got to 9 through 11, got confused, thought about the Jews, now he's coming back to 12 and he's going to talk about, you know, being a good person. It's not that. It's grounded in these theological arguments. It's not a new topic. It's a practical outworking. As the Jewish annotated New Testament comments regarding the usage of therefore, in view of what Paul has just argued about the role of Gentiles in God's plan, including how their interests are related to how God is working with the Israelites, he offers in chapters 12 through 15 the following exhortation for how these Gentiles ought to behave. It is not a blast of theology through 8 chapters, 3 chapters of diversion on Jews, and 12 on being good. It's good behavior driven by proper theology regarding the God of Israel and being a member of the family. So here's the process. The flow of thought for Paul's letter in short form. Gentiles, you are invited, you are included, you are embraced by the God of Israel. You are massively important just as you are. No need to become Jewish. No conversion required. You should be proud of your role, but don't be arrogant. Right? Spend a lot of time. Don't think you've replaced anyone, especially the natural branch. And he connects that point from chapter 11. Don't become arrogant, he says in verse 20, to chapter 12, verse 3. I say to everyone among you not to think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, but with sober judgment. To 12:16, live in harmony with one another. Don't be arrogant. Do you think he's really trying to get the message that you shouldn't be arrogant? He's really trying to get that through. Now, live in harmony with one another. Do not be arrogant, but associate with the lowly. Do not claim to be wiser than you are. How is that done? How to live in harmony? Paul answers, and it's very important. That's how he closes this book out on Jews and Gentiles living in community. This is how you live in harmony. It's a favorite idea in songs and messages. It's sort of an unpopular thing that we're supposed to do and don't do it, and it is two words, a living sacrifice. That's what you're supposed to do, he says. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, on the basis of God's mercy, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, which is your reasonable act of worship. Don't be conformed to this age. Be transformed by the renewing of the mind so that you may discern what is the will of God and what is good and acceptable and perfect. A living sacrifice. It sounds, so spiritual and theological and, we should ponder this. And it is those things in some ways. But Paul then proceeds very simply to show you what it looks like practically speaking. It's not that complicated. It's not easy, but it's not complicated. Summarized in one of my favorite Bible verses ever from Romans 12, if it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. 12:18. You want to be a living sacrifice? As much as it depends on you, live at peace with all, especially starting in your own home. My friends, it is a transformative way to live, a transformed, renewed mind living sacrifice. But that sort of seems like a contradiction, doesn't it? Living sacrifice? I mean, a sacrifice is, well, a sacrifice, something that dies, a living sacrifice. How does one live through that? Well, we know that Paul has already covered the death motif in chapter 6. He told his audience, guess what? You died. You died. What are we to say? Should we continue in sin in order that grace may increase? This is chapter 6. By no means. How can we who died to sin go on living in it? Do you not know that all of us who were baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death? Therefore, we were buried with him by baptism into death, so that just as Messiah was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, so we also might walk in newness of life. In other words, you died and you came back to life. Sort of, in Messiah. You're really going to do it later, but even now on earth. Death, life, living, sacrifice. Now, the expansion of that for Paul, which sounds incredibly similar to Yeshua's message in so many places, is this. Just as a sacrifice in the temple brings connection or reconnection or intimacy, restored intimacy to the one who brings it, so too Paul instructs his hearers by being this living sacrifice, your new life gained through death is going to bring you into the opportunity to serve others, to make connections, to have not Intimate is a word, but I don't mean it that way. To have spiritual intimacy. You're going to do that. That's a living sacrifice, and he tells us what it looks like. We can read chapter 12, just a little bit after, just the instructions that he gives us. If you go back up to like 12:6 or so, we have gifts that differ according to the grace given us, prophecy in proportion to faith, ministry, teaching, all of these things, exhortation, giving, these things we're going to do compassionately, we'll do in cheerfulness. And let love be genuine, hate what's evil, hold fast to what is good, love one another with mutual affection, outdo one another in showing honor. Do not lag in zeal, be ardent in spirit, serve the Lord. All of these things, this is his instruction. This is what it looks like to be a living sacrifice. So if you were curious about it, all you have to do is read what he says. I told you, it's hard, but it's not complicated. Okay? Die to your earthly desires. Now, who thinks that? Who thinks that's a sacrifice? Who does that every day without any difficulty at all? No one. It's hard. But it's not complicated. This, Paul says, is your reasonable act of worship. Your mind will be transformed into a new way of thinking and therefore a new way of acting in a new enlivened way, a living sacrifice. He says, this is your worship. The word is latria in Greek. You know what that word connects to in Hebrew? Avodah. Avodah means service. It's the temple service. It's the Passover service. It is a worship, acts of service, but dedication and worship. So Paul's saying that's what it's going to look like for you. It's got this little temple connection, which is kind of cool. But putting it plainly, we died to live that we might serve others. That's the message, really, of the last four chapters of the book of Romans, well, 12 through 15. 16 is its own thing. It's not a new direction. He meant to make this point from the beginning. And here's the thing about these gifts. They are notably corporate in their exercise, not merely individual. Together, when we exercise them, this is going to be what it looks like to have a living sacrifice as you being one. And that, my friends, goes quite far beyond the road to individual salvation, which is what the Romans road is supposed to be all about. This is what it's all about, actually. Now, Paul makes clear a huge component of this is to not think more highly of oneself than you ought to. Don't be super-minded, be sober-minded, okay? And we've learned for Paul that includes especially the Gentile acceptance of their dependence on the God of Israel, the Messiah of Israel, and the proper treatment of the Jewish people. Even those Jewish people who are not convinced that Jesus is the Messiah. Paul makes it clear. Do not be arrogant to the natural branch. He does not distinguish that the natural branch is only Jewish Jesus followers. Do not be arrogant, which brings us now into an interesting discussion in chapter 13. Let's read chapter 13. It's relatively short, but I want you to understand it and I want you to get it. So pull it up. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God, and those authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists what God has appointed. Those who resist will incur judgment. Rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Do you wish to have no fear of the authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive its approval. For it is God's servant for your good. But if you do what is wrong, you should be afraid, for the authority does not bear the sword in vain. It is the servant of God to execute wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be subject not only because of wrath, but because of conscience. For the same reason, you also pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants busy with this very thing. Pay to all what is due them, taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, honor to whom honor is due. We'll leave it at those seven verses for now, because I have this question. Who's he talking about? Who is he telling them to obey? Rome. Rome. That is the traditional perspective. Rome. The Roman government. And when I say traditional, I mean by like almost everyone's assessment, he is telling them, pay taxes to Rome. Messianic, across many, many boundaries of interpretation, not just Christian pastors and theologians. And it makes sense, right? It really does. Unlike our Western perspective, in which we, if we feel threatened or challenged by a government, we will stand up and overthrow it. We did it once. It worked out pretty good for us. Back in the 18th century, we rocked that thing. But let me tell you something. In Rome, they will kill you quicker than you can smile. That didn't work in Rome. Civil disobedience was, you know, not a thing. Rome would kill you and quick, they didn't tolerate. So Paul says, basically, this is a perspective, be good. Do what they say. They're not a good rulers are not a conduct to are not bad to good conduct. They're only bad to those who break the rules. So guess what? Don't break the rules. Okay? And we could tie this back to Romans 8, actually, this idea here that Paul would be talking to them about Rome. Why? Romans 8 is where he's saying, guys, I know it's difficult. The Spirit is yearning within us. We want to get out of here, and we need intercession. Why? Because it was difficult to be a Gentile believer in Rome. When you got rid of the family gods and you got rid of the idolatry, Rome didn't like you. And your family probably didn't like you. So Paul was talking to them about being energized and encouraged by the Spirit. Just hang on. Times are tough, but it's going to be okay. Why? Because Paul's a firm believer that Yeshua is on the doorstep. That's the sense of his urgency. He says at the end of this chapter, besides this, you know what time it is, how it is already the moment for you to wake from sleep, for salvation is nearer to us now than when we became believers. The night is far gone. The day is near. Friends, he'll be back soon, so hang on. Okay? Makes sense. Put your head down. Deal with the Roman government. Don't make a stink. Now, don't serve any stinky idols, but don't make a stink with the Roman government. It's a logical argument. It's supported by Scripture. Daniel had a similar situation. Judaism very much recognizes that God's sovereignty in using flawed human institutions like Rome for divine purposes, that can happen. That's what he means, the traditional says, for the authorities are God's agents. God put them in place. Believers, Paul is saying, you got to prioritize harmony, avoid rebellion. Even consistent with Yeshua's teaching in Mark, right? Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. This is not complicated. So I'll just say this very well could be Paul's intention. That is to keep this community safe until Messiah returns. Maybe they're really struggling to understand how to live under the rule of these idolaters, these Roman overlords. And while Paul does not suggest total surrender to ungodly rulers, in this case, as I said, he says, hang on till Yeshua comes back. You can do it with the help of the Spirit. He's interceding. Chapter 8, that makes sense. All of that makes sense. So who said Rome? It's a good answer. But this is a repaving project. Would you honestly expect me to not give you some other angle to consider as we're repaving a potential potholes? And admittedly, this is a minority opinion, one that could be criticized by the masses for its aggressive interpretive tendency, and yet, given the audience, the content, the context, the critical exigency, everything Paul said up to now and his purpose in the letter, this actually makes an incredible amount of sense and merits at least having it in your interpretive frame for chapter 13. And I'll tell you what it is in just a second. But before I present it, I want to present at least one major difficulty in the traditional understanding of this being Rome. Paul is writing to who? Living in Rome. So they are Romans. He's writing the letter to the Romans, to Romans living in Rome. And guess what? They know how things work in Rome. Does it make sense for Paul, who's never been to Rome? Yes, he's a Roman citizen. He had some knowledge, but he's never been to Rome. Does it make sense for him to suddenly, chapter 1 through 12, but now suddenly he switches into a lesson on civics and governmental obedience? It's sort of weird, but especially Romans knew the cost of disobedience to Rome. He didn't need to tell them this. It's a strange shift from chapter 12 to 13. But when we look at that shift from 12 to 13, and remember, there were no chapter and verse delineations here. The reader didn't say, okay, I want you to bless people, be a living sacrifice. Now, chapter 12 end, chapter 13, we're going to talk about the government now. Chapter 13, it didn't work like that. Chapter 12 and 13 flowed into one another, okay? And it's connected potentially to what comes before it. Maybe Paul isn't talking about obeying Rome, but someone else. Chapter 12 ends like this. Bless those who persecute you. Bless, do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be arrogant. Associate with the lowly. Do not claim to be wiser than you are. Don't repay anyone evil for evil. Take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If it's possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. So, be humble. It's been a big part of the last three chapters. The Jews are still in the plan of God. He's not forsaken them. They're serving a purpose for the Gentile community to enter the family of God, even and especially maybe those unconvinced and unpersuaded Jews and Gentiles should not be haughty or super-minded toward them because God is at work. And given all of that material, those concepts and the flow and the purpose of the letter, here is a proposed reinterpretation of who he's talking to, presented primarily by Mark Nanos and other minority scholars. Paul isn't talking about the Roman government. He's talking about the synagogue authorities that were overseeing the communities within which these Gentiles functioned. Specifically, unconvinced synagogue authorities who may be making some aspects of life difficult for Gentiles entering into the community as disciples of Yeshua. Now listen, clearly stated, we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the community of Gentile believers were living, learning, and worshiping within the synagogue with Jews. Who ran the synagogue? Jews. Thus, these Gentiles likely attended synagogue gatherings and were subject to Jewish community norms and leadership. It's not up for debate that this was a Jewish movement. It was later that the Gentiles created a non-Jewish, Gentile-led movement with popes and priests. But the synagogue authorities who are leading, ruling, if you will, if we can use that word, over communities where these Gentiles are integrated, it certainly makes some, if not a lot more sense, that Paul would call them God's agents, which he actually does in the text. Not Roman senators, emperors, and tax collectors. Thus, Gentile believers should respect the traditions and decisions of synagogue leaders, even if they're not messianic. Because God isn't done with them yet, right? We just read chapters 9 through 11 and studied that extensively. The attitude of peace by the Gentiles in synagogues under their authority, that would foster peace and humility and continuity between Jewish and Gentile believers in the Roman Messianic community. Furthermore, Paul does not want Gentiles to be a stumbling block for unpersuaded Jews to follow Messiah. If they come in and they make a big stink against the leadership, they're going to be a stumbling block to Jews getting on board with Paul's mission. So he says, don't do that. Furthermore, it is also a place of relative safety for these Gentile disciples because the synagogue is an approved cult by the Roman government perspective. They could be safely guarded in the synagogue. If they make a stink and are kicked out of the synagogue, they are in jeopardy, greater jeopardy. They needed this authority. They needed this place. So maybe it's self-protective beyond the spiritual and community component. It was practical advice for Gentiles. They would be protected then from Roman intrusion into their new faith identity. Now listen, I understand that's not a widely held view, but when we consider it, given all that we've learned, it has merit, for sure. Gentile pushback on non-Yeshua following Jewish leadership makes more sense than actually pushing back on the all-powerful Roman government, does it not? I think it does. The Gentile community was growing, probably relatively quickly. Paul has made this clear. First of all, Yeshua is the future, the way of salvation, the key to the kingdom. The Gentiles have received that message. They're positioned properly for his return. And Paul has made clear that many of his own Jewish brothers have not seen that. They are not persuaded about Yeshua. They have stumbled, though they have not fallen, which would raise for me, if I were a Gentile in this community, this would raise a logical issue for me. If all that, why would I listen to them? Why should I fall under the authority if they've missed the message that I so clearly have received? And as I've said all along in this series, why, if I'm that Gentile, would I not be arrogant toward them and think, I can do better, I have Jesus? Why would I consent to pay the 2 drachma temple tax to be sent to some Jewish place in Jerusalem where they're sacrificing animals? Why would I consent to that under them? Paul talks a lot about paying the tax, right? As we'll read, why would I, as a Gentile who's received the message of Messiah, just for recording purposes and in case anyone took this out of context, I'm not a Gentile, I'm actually Jewish. I'm doing something called speech in character. If I were a Gentile, why in the world would I submit to these instructions about food and holy days, etc., if they don't even have Jesus? And that's coming up in chapter 14. So these are good questions, right? But again, according to the interpretation, Paul suggests that it is their responsibility to submit to the authority of the community in which they participate. Now, the big objection to that comes from verse 4, where it says something about they hold the sword, okay? What vision of a Roman centurion does not have him holding up this grand sword and shield and the big carpet helmet thing sword? First of all, it's not that kind of sword. He's using the Greek word for a little dagger, okay? But who else carries a sword? I mean, the traditional view says that represents the power of the Roman state. to punish wrongdoers, capital punishment, all of that. But in Nanos' view, the sword is metaphorical for synagogue leaders' authority to enforce communal discipline and preserve order, particularly in the context of Torah observance and Jewish-Gentile relations. Paul himself had been disciplined by the synagogue and was disciplined by the authorities. I bet it didn't feel good. They may not have stabbed him with a sword, but they had the authority to inflict discipline on those who were wreaking havoc in the community. The synagogue would have had every right to remove Gentiles making claims or making difficulty that were unwilling to adopt the proper behavior of righteous Gentiles, that they were unwilling to demonstrate their fidelity to God, to the law, to the people. They had that authority. And so Nanos says this sword represents this disciplinary ability, which they had. I don't carry a sword around here. I should. That would be fun. But I'd want one of the big ones where I could go. But if there's an issue, then I and the elders have the authority to deal with that. That's the way leadership structures work. Okay? So all that to say in conclusion, it's an interpretation very much worth considering. Paul never supposed that the Gentiles would start a new religion and a new authority structure, as I said, of popes and priests. He never, ever thought that would be the case. They would, as long as they needed to until Messiah came, they would function in the system of the synagogue that God had established. That's what Paul knew. Now I'm going to leave that point there, okay? That's it. There are many, many, if you really, really want to get into that, there's a book by Mark Nanos that's called The Mystery of Romans. It's a 1996 monograph where he spends 50 pages going into this proof with all the Greek and all of this other stuff. It's a great book to have on your shelf anyway, The Mystery of Romans. But I remind you that when I was in San Diego for SBL, the Society for Biblical Literature, I had lunch with Mark Nanos and we were chatting a bit. And you know, that book is almost 30 years old. And so the question was asked, do you still believe everything you wrote in The Mystery of Romans in 1996? He said, no, some things have changed, but not that. Because that is pretty good. And it's just so wonderfully flowing right down our Romans road. So in conclusion, it's this. Paul could be telling us that we need to obey the government in the cities in which we live. That's a Jewish idea. When you're in exile, you obey to a certain point. There are certain things you die for, but to generally speaking, you follow the civil authorities. That's a Jewish idea. And for the most part, we should do that, okay? So I'm not telling you that that couldn't be what Paul's saying, but I am telling you, this makes a lot of sense. What we have in Romans 12 through 15, though we've only covered 12 through 13, is called paranesis in Greek. It's a biblical studies term. It's about moral and ethical exhortation, practical advice, guiding behavior based on these established principles and beliefs. Paul has spent all this time establishing these principles and beliefs for Gentiles, specifically in Rome. And he's asking them to be a living sacrifice, and as much as it depends on them, be at peace with all men. That includes potentially the synagogue leadership. That is their proper worship, their proper service, their proper avodah. And as Paul concludes his letter to the Romans, he is very clear in his purpose. We have to get along with each other, even if we have points of disagreement. And when we see the letter from chapter 1 to 16 as a unit of communication, brilliantly constructed from a theological perspective, strategically worded to communicate the practical, ethical living between Jews and Gentiles, we're able to see the true beauty of Paul's genius. This is what it takes to get beyond tradition. And as he intended it, owe no one anything except to love one another, for the one who loves one another has fulfilled the law. This is the commandments: you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this word: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore love is fulfilling the law. Paul, like Yeshua, intends to demonstrate not the end of the law, but the filling full of it. The same usage, plural, that Yeshua uses when he says, I didn't come to abolish but to fulfill. It's the same thing Paul's saying here in chapters 12 and 13. Fill it full. And how do you do it? You do it in love. That's actually what Romans is about. He's not quite finished making that point, so we will finish it for him next week.
Shalom. I'm Darren with Shalom Macon. If you enjoyed this teaching, I want to ask you to take the next step. Start by making sure you're subscribed to our channel. Next, make sure you hit the like button on this video so that others know it's worth their time to watch. Last, head over to our website to learn more about Shalom Macon, explore other teachings and events, and if you're so inclined, contribute to the work that we're doing to further the kingdom. Thanks for watching and connecting with Shalom Macon.